sacrifices. But there was no pity here. Here, when the men spoke of the ruination that was upon them, how Ruby was changing in intolerable ways, they did not think to fix it by extending a hand in fellowship or love. They mapped defense instead and honed evidence for its need, till each piece fit an already polished groove. A few did most of the talking, some said little, and two said nothing at all. But silent though they were, Lone knew the leadership was twinned. Remember how they scandalized the wedding?
What you say?
Uh-huh. And it was that very same day I caught them kissing on each other in the back of that ratty Cadillac. Very same day. And if that wasn't enough to please the devil, two more was fighting over them in the dirt. Right down in it. Lord, I hate a nasty woman. Sweetie said they tried their best to poison her. I heard that too. Got caught in a snowstorm out that way and took shelter with them. Should have known better. Well, you know, sweetie. Anyway, said she heard noises coming from somewhere in that house. Sounded to her like little babies crying. What in God's name little babies doing out there? You asking me? Whatever it is, it ain't natural. Well, it used to house little girls, didn't it? Yeah, I remember. Said it was a school. School for what? What they teaching out there? Sergeant, didn't you find marijuana growing in the middle of your alfalfa? Yep, sure did. That don't surprise me. All I know is they beat Arnett up some when she went out there to confront them about the lies they told her. She thinks they kept her baby and told her it was stillborn. My wife says they did an abortion on her. You believe it? I don't know, but I wouldn't put it past them. What I do know is how messed up her face was. Oh, man, we can't have this. Roger told me that the mother, you know, the old white one, used to shop here sometimes. Well, he said when she died, she weighed less than 50 pounds and shone like sulfur. Jesus, said the girl he dropped off there was openly flirting with him. That's the one half naked all the time. I knew something was wrong with her from the time she stepped off the bus. How'd she get a bus to come out here anyway? Guess why, don't you? You think they got powers? I know they got powers. Question is, whose power is stronger? Why don't they just get on out, leave? Huh. Would you, if you had a big old house to live in without having to work for it? Something's going on out there, and I don't like any of it. No men kissing on themselves, babies hid away. Jesus, no telling what else. Look what happened to Billy Delia after she started hanging around out there. Knocked her mama down the stairs and took off for that place like a shote hunting teat. I hear they drink like fish, too. The old woman was always drunk when I saw her, and remember the first words out their mouths when they came to the wedding? Anything to drink is what they asked for. And when they got a glass of lemonade, they acted like they'd been spit on and walked out the door. I remember that. Bitches. More like witches. But look here, brother. The bones beat all. I can't believe a whole family died out there without nobody knowing it. They wasn't all that far away. Know what I'm saying? Can't nobody tell me they left the road and got themselves lost in a field with a big old house less than 2 miles away? They would have seen it, had to. The man would have got out and walked to it. See what I mean? He could reason, couldn't he? And even if he couldn't reason, he could see. How are you going to miss a house that size out here and land flat as a nailhead? You saying they had something to do with it? Listen, nothing ever happened around here like what's going on now. Before those heifers came to town, this was a peaceable kingdom. The others before them at least had some religion. These here sluts out there by themselves never stepped foot in a church, and I bet you a dollar to a fat nickel they ain't thinking about one either. They don't need men, and they don't need God. Can't say they haven't been warned. Asked first, and then warned. If they stay to themselves, that'd be something, but they don't. They meddle, drawing folks out there like flies to shit, and everybody who goes near them is maimed somehow, and the mess is seeping back into our homes, our families. We can't have it, you all. Can't have it at all. So, Lone thought, the fangs and the tail are somewhere else, out yonder, all slithery in a house full of women. Not women locked safely away from men, but worse, women who chose themselves for company, which is to say, not a convent, but a coven. Lone shook her head and adjusted her doublement. She was listening only half-heartedly to the words, trying to divine the thoughts behind them. Some of it she got right away. Sargent, she knew, would be nodding at every shred of gossip, chewing on the rag end of truth, and wondering aloud why this deliberately beautiful town, governed by responsible men, couldn't remain so stable, prosperous, with no talk-back young people. Why would they want to leave and raise families and customers elsewhere? But he would be thinking how much less his outlay would be if he owned the convent land, and how, if the women are gone from there, he would be in a better position to own it. Everyone knew he had already visited the convent to warn them, which is to say, he offered to buy the place. And when the response was an incomprehensible stare, he told the old woman to think carefully, and that other things could happen to lower the price. Wisdom Pool would be looking for a reason to explain why he had no control anymore over his brothers and sisters, to explain how it happened that those who used to worship him, listen to him, were now strays trying to be on their own. The shooting last year between Brood and Apollo was over Billy Delia and would be enough reason for him to go gallivanting off for the pleasure of throwing some women in the road. Billy Delia was friendly with those women, made one of his younger brothers drive her out there, and it was after that that the trouble between Apollo and Brood turned dangerous. Neither one had followed Wisdom's orders to never speak to or look at that girl again. The result was biblical, a man lying in wait to slaughter his brother. As for the Fleetwoods, Arnold and Jeff, well, they'd been wanting to blame somebody for Sweetie's children for a long time. Maybe it was the midwife's fault. Maybe it was the government's fault. But the midwife could only be disemployed, and the government was not accountable. And although Lone had delivered some of Jeff's sick children long before the first woman arrived, they wouldn't let a little thing like that keep them from finding fault anywhere but in their own blood. Or Sweetie's. Menace, well, he'd be ripe for a raid on anybody. Spending those weeks out there drying out, you'd think he'd be grateful. Those women must have witnessed some things, seen some things he didn't want ranging around in anybody's mind in case they fell out of their mouths. Or maybe it was just to erase the shame he felt at having let Harper and the others talk him out of marrying that woman he brought home. That pretty red-boned girl, they told him, was not good enough for him. Said she was more like a fast woman than a bride. He let out like he drank because of what Vietnam had done to him. But Lone thought the pretty red-boned girl's loss was more to the point. He hadn't had the courage to leave and go on and live with her someplace else, chose instead both to submit to his father's rule and charge him a neat price for it, undisturbed acceptance of his affliction, getting rid of some unattached women who had wiped up after him, washed his drawers, removed his vomit, listened to his curses as well as his sobs, might convince him for a while that he was truly a man unpolluted by his mother's weakness, worthy of his father's patience, and that he was right to let the red bone go. Lone could not count how many times she had sat in New Zion and heard his father, Harper, begin to testify, begin to examine his own sins, and end up going on about loose women who could keep you from knowing who, what, and where your children are. He married a black horse woman, Catherine, and worried her into nervous digestion, carrying on about what she was doing and who she was seeing and this and that, and was she properly instructing their daughter, Kate. Kate got married as fast as she could, just to get out from under his hand. His first wife, Minnie's mother, Martha, must have given him a bad time. So bad, he never let their only son forget it. Then there was K.D., the family man, talking about how strange one of those convent girls was, and how he knew it right away, soon as he saw her get off the bus. Ha ha. He's a daddy now, of a four-month-old son with all its fingers and toes, and who knows, maybe a full brain too, courtesy of the doctor willing to treat black folks in Denby. So he and Arnett both sniffed their noses at Lone. And however happy Arnett must be now and willing to pass her earlier mistake off on the convent women's tricking her, K.D. would have another grudge. The girl whose name he now scandalized, he had stalked for years till she threw him out the door. Take a whole lot of healthy babies to make him forget that. He's a Morgan, after all, and they haven't forgotten a thing since 1755. Lone understood these private thoughts, and some of what steward and deacon's motive might be. Neither one put up with what he couldn't control. But she could not have imagined steward's rancor, his bile at the thought that his grandnephew, maybe, had surely been hurt or destroyed in that place. It was a floating blister in his bloodstream, which neither shrank nor came to a head. Nor could she have imagined how deep in the meat of his brain stem lay the memory of how close his brother came to breaking up his marriage to Soane. How off the course Deke slid when he was looking in those poison and poisoning eyes. For months, the two of them had met secretly. For months, Deke was distracted, making mistakes, and just supposed the hussy had gotten pregnant. Had a mixed-up child. Stuart seethed at the thought of that barely averted betrayal of all they owed and promised the old fathers. But a narrowly escaped treason against the father's law, the law of continuance and multiplication, was overwhelmed by the permanent threat to his cherished view of himself and his brother. The women in the convent were for him a flaunting parody of the 19 Negro ladies of his and his brother's youthful memory and perfect understanding. They were the degradation of that moment they'd shared of sunlit skin and verbena. They, with their mindless giggling, outraged the dulcet tones, the tinkling in the merry and welcoming laughter of the 19 ladies who, scheduled to live forever in pastel-shaded dreams, were now doomed to extinction by this new an obscene breed of female. He could not abide them for sullying his personal history with their streetwalkers' clothes and whores' appetites, mocking and desecrating the vision that carried him and his brother through a war that imbued their marriages and strengthened their efforts to build a town where the vision could flourish. He would never forgive them that, and he would not tolerate this loss of charity. Nor did Lone know the glacier that was Deacon Morgan's pride, its hidden bulk, its accretion and unmovability. She knew about his long-ago relationship with Consolata, but she could not have fathomed his personal shame or understood how important it was to erase both the shame and the kind of woman he believed was its source, an uncontrollable, gnawing woman who had bitten his lip just to lap the blood it shed, a beautiful, golden-skinned, outside woman with moss-green eyes that tried to trap a man, close him up in a cellar room with liquor to enfeeble him so they could do carnal things, unnatural things in the dark. A Salome from whom he had escaped just in time, or she would have had his head on a dinner plate. That ravenous, ground-fucking woman who had not left his life but had weaseled her way into Soane's affections, and, he suspected, had plied her with evil potions to make her less loving than she used to be. And it was not the eternal grieving for their sons that froze her, but the mess she was swallowing still, given to her by the woman whose very name she herself had made into a joke and a travesty of what a woman should be. Lone couldn't know all, but she knew enough, and the flashlights had revealed the equipment. Handcuffs glinted, rope coiled, and she did not have to guess what else they had. Stepping softly, she made her way along the edge of the stream toward her car. Thy will, she whispered, convinced that what she had heard and surmised was no idleness. The men had not come there merely to rehearse, like boot camp recruits, like invaders preparing for slaughter. They were there to rave, to heat the blood or turn it icicle cold, the better to execute the mission. One thing in particular she had quickly understood. The only voice not singing belonged to the one conducting the choir. Where is Richard Meisner? Lone didn't bother to say hello. She had knocked on Meisner's door, then entered his house to find it dark and empty. Now she had roused his closest neighbor, Francis Poole Dupre, from her sleep. Francis groaned. What in the world is going on with you, Lone? Tell me where Meisner is. They're gone to Muskegee. Why? They who? Reverend Meisner and Anna. A conference. What do you need him for this time of night? Let me in, said Lone, and stepped past Francis into the living room. Come on in the kitchen, said Francis. No time. Listen. Lone described the meeting, saying a whole passel of menfolk planning something against the convent. Morgan's, Fleetwood's, and Wisdom's there, too. They're going after those women out there. Lord, what kind of mess is this? They're going to scare them off in the middle of the night? Woman, listen to me. Those men got guns with sights on them. That doesn't mean anything. I've never seen my brother go anywhere, minus his rifle, except church. And even then, it's in the car. They got rope, too, Franny. Rope, 2-inch. What are you thinking? We wasting time. Where's Sut? Sleep. Wake him. I'm not going to disturb my husband for some wild... Wake him, Franny. I'm not a crazy woman, and you know it. The first drops were warm and fat, carrying the scent of white loco and chola from regions north and west. They smashed into gentian desert trumpets and slid from chicory leaves. Plump and slippery, they rolled like mercury beads over the cracked earth between garden rows. As they sat in kitchen light, Lone, Francis, and Sut Dupre could see, even smell, the rainfall, but they could not hear it, so soft, so downy were the drops. Sut was unconvinced that Lone's demand to rush out and stop them was called for, but he did agree to speak to Reverends Pulliam and Carey in the morning. Lone said morning might be too late, and took off in a huff to find somebody who didn't talk to her as if she were a child unable to wake from a nightmare. Anna Flood was gone. She couldn't go to Soane because of Deke, and since K.D. and Arnett had taken the house that Menace used to own, Dovey Morgan wouldn't be in town. She thought about Kate, but knew she would not go up against her father. She considered Penelope, but dismissed her, since she was not only married to Wisdom, she was Sargent's daughter. Lone realized that she would have to go out to the ranches and farms, to people she trusted most, not to let family relations cloud their minds. Working windshield wipers were an unavailable blessing, so Lone, rolling gum slowly around in her mouth, concentrated on being careful, driving past the deserted oven, pleased she had gotten the May apples in time. She noticed there were no lights at Anna's place, or way back of it in Deke Morgan's house. Lone squinted to negotiate the few miles of dirt road between Ruby's and the county's. It could be a tricky stretch because the earth was absorbing the rain now, swelling the roots of parched plants and forming rivulets wherever it could. She drove slowly, thinking if this mission was truly God's intention, nothing could stop her. Halfway to Aaron Poole's house, the Oldsmobile halted in a roadside ditch. Around the time Lone Dupre was trying to avoid the early melon sign, the men were finalizing details over coffee and something stronger for those who wished. None was a drinker except Menace, but they did not object to lacing tonight's coffee. Behind Sargent's barn-like building, where his trade took place, beyond the paddock where he once kept horses, was a shed. In it he repaired tack, a hobby now, no longer a chargeable service, ruminated and avoided the women in his family. A male cozy, it was equipped with a small stove, a freezer, a work table, and chairs, all standing on an unruinable floor. The men had just begun to blow in their cups when the rain started. After a few swallows, they joined Sargent in the yard to move sacks and cover equipment with tarpaulin. When they returned, drenched, to the shed, they found themselves lighthearted and suddenly hungry. Sargent suggested beefsteaks and went in his house to get what was needed to feed the men. Priscilla, his wife, heard him and offered to help, but he sent her back to bed firmly. The scented rainfall drummed. The atmosphere in the shed was braced, companionable, as the men ate thick steaks, prepared the old-fashioned way, fried in a piping hot skillet. The rain's perfume was stronger north of Ruby, especially at the convent, where thick white clover and Scotch broom colonized every place but the garden. Mavis and Pallas, aroused from sleep by its aroma, rushed to tell Consolata, Grace, and Seneca that the longed-for rain had finally come. Gathered in the kitchen door, first they watched, then they stuck out their hands to feel it. It was like lotion on their fingers. So they entered it and let it pour like balm on their shaved heads and upturned faces. Consolata started it. The rest were quick to join her. There are great rivers in the world, and on their banks and the edges of oceans, children thrill to water. In places where rain is light, the thrill is almost erotic. But those sensations bow to the rapture of holy women dancing in hot, sweet rain. They would have laughed had enchantment not been so deep. If there were any recollections of a recent warning or intimations of harm, the irresistible rain washed them away. Seneca embraced and finally let go of a dark morning in state housing. Grace witnessed the successful cleansing of a white shirt that never should have been stained. Mavis moved in the shudder of rows of Sharon petals tickling her skin. Pallas, delivered of a delicate son, held him close while the rain rinsed away a scary woman on an escalator and all fear of black water. Consolata, fully housed by the god who sought her out in the garden, was the more furious dancer. Mavis, the most elegant. Seneca and Grace danced together, then parted to skip through fresh mud. Pallas, smoothing raindrops from her baby's head, swayed like a frond. Finally out of the ditch, Lone naturally sought out a Dupre. She had been reared in that family, rescued, then taught by one of the daughters. More than that, she knew what they were made of, Pius Dupre, son of Booker Dupre, and nephew to the famous Juvenal Dupre, was her first choice. Like the Morgans and Black Horses, they were pleased to be descendants of men who had governed in state houses, but unlike them, they were prouder of earlier generations. Artisans, gunsmiths, seamstresses, lace makers, cobblers, ironmongers, masons, whose serious work was stolen from them by white immigrants. Their deeper reverence was for the generations that had seen their shops burned and their supplies thrown overboard, because white immigrants could not trust or survive fair competition. Their people had been arrested, threatened, purged, and eliminated from skilled labor and craft. But the families held on to what they could and what they had gained from 1755, when the first Dupre carried a white napkin over his arm and a prayer book in his pocket. The belief that steadied them was not grim. Virtue, unexpected goodness, made them smile. Deliberate righteousness lifted their hearts as little else could. They did not always know what it was, but they spent a lot of time trying to find out. Long before Juvenal was elected to the state house, supper conversation at a Dupre table focused on the problems each member was having, how each and all could handle or help. And always the turn was on the ethics of a deed, the clarity of motives, whether a behavior advanced his glory and kept his trust. None of the current Dupres liked or approved of the convent women, but that was way beside the point. The actions of Brood and Apollo had insulted them. Wisdom Pool was brother to their daughter-in-law, and in his participation in a group intent on hurting women, for whatever reason, they would quickly see the monster's handiwork. And so they did. When Lone told them all she had heard and what she knew, Pius wasted no time. He instructed his wife, Melinda, to get over to the Beauchamp's place, tell Wren and Luther to meet him. He and Lone would get to Deed Sands and Aaron Pool. Melinda said they ought to notify Dovey, but they could not agree on how to do that if Stewart was there. Lone did not know if they had already started for the convent or were waiting for sunrise, but said someone should risk it and inform Dovey, who could, if she wanted to, let Soane know what was going on. Tired from their night dance, but happy, the women returned to the house. Drying themselves, they asked Consolata to tell them again about Piedad while they oiled their heads with wintergreen. We sat on the shore walk. She bathed me in emerald water. Her voice made proud women weep in the streets. Coins fell from the fingers of artists and policemen, and the country's greatest chefs begged us to eat their food. Piedad had songs that could still a wave, make it pause in its curl, listening to language it had not heard since the sea opened. Shepherds with colored birds on their shoulders came down from mountains to remember their lives in her songs. Travelers refused to board homebound ships while she sang. At night, she took the stars out of her hair and wrapped me in its wool. Her breath smelled of pineapple and cashews. The women sleep, wake, and sleep again with images of parrots, crystal seashells, and a singing woman who never spoke. At 4 in the morning, they wake to prepare for the day. One mixes dough while another lights the stove. Others gather vegetables for the noon meal, then set out the breakfast things. The bread, kneaded into mounds, is placed in baking tins to rise. Sunlight is yearning for brilliance when the men arrive. The stone-washed blue of the sky is hard to break, but by the time the men park behind Shen Oak and start for the convent, the sun has cracked through, glorious blue. The water of the night rises as mist from puddles and flooded crevices in the road's shoulder. When they reach the convent, they avoid loud gravel crunch by weaving through tall grass and occasional rainbows to the front door. The claws, perhaps, snatch Stewart out of the world. Mottled and glistening from rain, they flank the steps. As he mounts between them, he raises his chin and then his rifle and shoots open a door that has never been locked. It slants inward on its hinges. Sun follows him in, splashing the walls of the foyer where sexualized infants play with one another through flaking paint. Suddenly, a woman with the same white skin appears, and all Stewart needs to see are her sensual, appraising eyes to pull the trigger again. The other men are startled, but not deterred from stepping over her, fondling their weapons, feeling suddenly so young and good, they are reminded that guns are more than decoration, intimidation, or comfort. They are meant. Deep gives the orders. The men separate. Three women preparing food in the kitchen hear a shot, a pause. Another shot. Cautiously, they look through the swinging door. Backed by light from the slanted door, shadows of armed men loom into the hallway. The women race to the game room and close the door seconds before the men position themselves in the hall. They hear footsteps pass and enter the kitchen they have just left. No windows in the game room. The women are trapped and know it. Minutes pass. Arnold and Jeff Fleetwood leave the kitchen and notice a trace of wintergreen in the air. They open the game room door. An alabaster ashtray slams into Arnold's temple, exhilarating the woman wielding it. She continues to smash until he is down on all fours, while Jeff, taken off guard, aims his gun a tick too late. It flies from his hand when a cue stick cracks his wrist and then, on upswing, rams into his jaw. He raises his arm, first for protection, then to snatch the point of the cue when the frame of Catherine of Siena breaks over his head. The women run into the hall, but freeze when they see two figures exit the chapel. As they run back to the kitchen, Harper and Menace are close behind. Harper grabs the waist and arm of one. She is a handful, so he doesn't see the skillet swinging into his skull. He falls, dropping his gun. Menace, struggling to handcuff the wrists of another, turns when his father goes down. The stock that drenches his face is so hot he can't yell. He drops to one knee, and a woman's hand reaches for the gun spinning on the floor. Hurt, half-blinded, he yanks her left ankle. She crashes, kicking at his head with her right foot. Behind him, a woman aims a butcher knife and plunges it so deep in the shoulder bone she can't remove it for a second strike. She leaves it there and escapes into the yard with the other two, scattering foul as they go. Coming from the second floor, Wisdom Pool and Sergeant Person see no one. They enter the schoolroom where light pours through the windows. They search behind desks, pushed to the wall, even though it is clear nobody, even a child, is small enough to hide there. Down below, under long, slow beams of a Black and Decker, Steward, Deke, and K.D. observe defilement and violence and perversions beyond imagination. Lovingly drawn filth carpets the stone floor. K.D. fingers his palm cross. Deke taps his shirt pocket where sunglasses are tucked. He had thought he might use them for other purposes, but he wonders if he needs them now to shield from his sight this sea of depravity beckoning below. None dare step on it. More than justified in their expectations, they turn around and climb the stairs. The schoolroom door is wide open. Sergeant and Wisdom motion them in. Bunched at the windows, all five understand. The women are not hiding. They are loose. Shortly after the men have left Sergeant's place, the citizens of Ruby arrive at the oven. The rain is slowing. The trash barrel swirls with debris. The stream has crested, but doesn't overflow its banks. It seeps underground instead. Rain cascading off the oven's head meets mud speckled with grout flakes washed away from bricks. The oven shifts just slightly on one side. The impacted ground on which it rests is undermined. In trucks and cars, the citizens go to meet the men. Neither of the sisters needs persuading, for both have known something awful was happening. Dovey asks Soane to drive. Each is silent with loud, rocketing thoughts. Dovey has watched her husband destroy something in himself for 30 years. The more he gained, the less he became. Now he may be ruining everything. Had 25 years of rampant success confused him? Did he think that because they lived away from white law, they were beyond it? Of course, no one could ask for a more doting husband, and as long as she ignored the unknowable parts, their marriage seemed perfect. Still, she misses the little foreclosed house where her friend visited. Only once since KG took it over has he come to her, and that was in a dream where he was moving away from her. She called. He turned. Next thing she knew, she was washing his hair. She woke puzzled, but pleased to see that her hands were wet from the suds. Soane is chastising herself for not having talked, just talked, to Deke. Told him she knew about Connie, that the loss of their third child was a judgment against her, not him. After Connie saved Scout's life, Soane's resentment against her evaporated, and because the two of them had become fast friends, she believed she had forgiven Deke also. Now she wondered whether her fear of suffocating in air too thin for breathing, her unrelieved mourning for her sons, keeping the ache alive by refusing to read their last letters, were ways of punishing him without seeming to. In any case, she was certain that routing the convent women had something to do with their marriage. Harper, Sargent, and certainly Arnold wouldn't lift a hand to those women if Deke and Stewart had not authorized and manipulated them. If only she had talked 22 years ago. Just talked. "What do you think?" Davy broke the silence. "I can't. They wouldn't hurt them, would they?" Soane cut off the wipers. There was no need for them now. "No," she answered, "just scare them. Into leaving, I mean. People talk about them all the time, though, like they were slime. They're different is all. I know, but that's been enough before. These are women, Davy, just women. Whores, though, and strange, too. Davy, that's what Stewart said. And if he believes it, I don't care if they're..." Soane couldn't imagine worse. Both became quiet. "Lone said KD is out there. He would be. You think Mabel knows? Or Priscilla?" asked Davy. "Doubt it. Hadn't been for Lone, would we? It'll be all right, I guess. Aaron and Pius will stop them. And the Beauchamps. Even Stewart won't mess with Luther." The sisters laughed then, small, hopeful laughs, soothing themselves as they sped through glorious dawn air. Consolata wakes. Seconds earlier, she thought she heard footsteps descending. She assumed it was Pallas coming to nurse the baby lying beside her. She touches the diaper to see if a change is needed. Something, something. Consolata goes chill. Opening the door, she hears retreating steps, too heavy, too many for a woman. She considers whether or not to disturb the baby's sleep. Then, quickly slipping on a dress, blue with a white collar, she decides to leave the child on the cot. She climbs the stairs and sees immediately a shape lying in the foyer. She runs to it and cradles the woman in her arms, smearing her cheek and the left side of her dress with blood. The pulse at the neck is there but not strong. The breathing is shallow. Consolata rubs the fuzz on the woman's head and begins to step in, deep, deeper, to find the pinpoint of light. Shots ring from the next room. Men are firing through the window at three women running through clover and scotch broom. Consolata enters, bellowing, "No!" The men turn. Consolata narrows her gaze against the sun, then lifts it as though distracted by something high above the heads of the men. "You're back," she says, and smiles. Deacon Morgan needs the sunglasses, but they are nestled in his shirt pocket. He looks at Consolata and sees in her eyes what has been drained from them and from himself as well. There is blood near her lips. It takes his breath away. He lifts his hand to halt his brothers and discovers who, between them, is the stronger man. The bullet enters her forehead. Dovey is screaming. Soane is staring. This dying may take a while. Lone is desperate for doublement as she staunches the white woman's wound. She and Wren have carried her to the sofa in the game room. Lone can't hear a heartbeat, and although the neck pulse seems still to be there, too much blood has left this woman with wrists small as a child's. "Has anybody gone for Roger?" she shouts. "Yes," somebody shouts back. The noise outside the room is giving her a headache, along with a fierce desire to chew. Lone leaves the woman to see what is being done to salvage a life or two from the mess. Dovey is weeping on the stairs. "Dovey, you have to shut up now. I need a thinking woman. Come in here and get some water. Try to get that girl in there to drink it." She drags her toward the kitchen where Soane is. Earlier, Deacon Morgan had carried Consolata into the kitchen, holding her in his arms for the time it took the women to clear the table. He laid her down carefully, as though any rough gesture might hurt her. It was after Consolata was comfortable, Soane's raincoat folded under her head, that his hands trembled. Then he left to help with the wounded men. Menace, unable to get the knife from his shoulder, was whinnying in pain. Harper's head was swelling, but it was Arnold Fleetwood who seemed to be suffering a concussion, and Jeff's broken jaw and cracked wrist needed attention. Other Ruby people, stirred by the first caravan, had arrived, increasing twofold the disorder and the din. Reverend Pulliam removed the knife from Menace's shoulder and had great difficulty trying to get both jurymen and the Fleetwoods to agree to go to the Denby Hospital. A message came from Deed San's son that Roger's return from Middleton was expected this morning, and soon as he got back, his daughter would send him along. Pulliam was finally persuasive and drove the hurt men away. Male voices continued to boom. Between loud accusations and sullen, if quieter, defense, under the onslaught of questions and prophecies of doom, it was a half hour or so before anyone thought to ask what had happened to the other women. When Pius did, Sergeant indicated out there with a head motion. "Run off? To the sheriff? Doubt that. What, man? They went down in the grass. You all massacred those women? For what? Now we got Whitelaw on us, as well as damnation. We didn't come here to kill anybody. Look what they did to Menace and Fleet. It was self-defense." Aaron Poole looked at K.D., who had offered that explanation. "You come in their house and don't expect them to fight you?" The contempt in his eyes was clear, but not as chilling as Luther's. "Who had the guns?" asked Luther. "We all did, but it was Uncle Stewart who—" Stewart slapped him full in the mouth, and had it not been for Simon Carey, another massacre might have taken place. "Hold that man," shouted Reverend Carey, and pointing to K.D., "you in trouble, son." Pius banged his fists on the wall. "You have already dishonored us. Now you're going to destroy us? What manner of evil is in you?" He had been looking at Stuart, but now his gaze took in Wisdom, Sergeant, and the other two. "The evil is in this house," said Stuart. "Go down in that cellar and see for yourself." "My brother's lying. This is our doing, ours alone, and we bear the responsibility." For the first time in 21 years, the twins looked each other dead in the eyes. Meanwhile, Sohn and Lone Dupre close the two pale eyes, but can do nothing about the third one, wet and lidless in between. "She said, 'Divine,'" Sohn whispers. "What?" Lone is trying to organize a sheet to cover the body. "When I went to her, right after Stuart, I held her head and she said, 'Divine.' Then something like, 'He's divine. He's sleeping divine.' Dreaming, I guess." "Well, she was shot in the head, Sohn. What do you think she saw?" "I don't know. But it's a sweet thought, even if it was her last." Dovey comes in saying, "She's gone." "You sure?" asks Lone. "Go look for yourself." "I will." The sisters cover Consolata with the sheet. "I didn't know her as well as you," Dovey says. "I loved her. As God is my witness, I did. But nobody knew her, really." "Why did they do it?" "They? You mean he, don't you? Stuart killed her, not Deke. You make it sound as though it's all his fault." "I didn't mean to." "Then what? What did you mean?" Sohn does not know what she means, other than how to locate a sliver of soap to clean away any little taint she can. But it is an exchange that alters their relationship irrevocably. Bewildered, angry, sad, frightened, people pile into cars, making their way back to children, livestock, fields, household chores, and uncertainty. How hard they had worked for this place. How far away they once were from the terribleness they have just witnessed. How could so clean and blessed a mission devour itself and become the world they had escaped? Lone has said she would stay with the bodies until Roger got there. Melinda asks, "How will you get back? Your car is at our place." Lone sighs. "Well, the dead don't move, and Roger's got a lot of work to do." As the car pulls away, Lone looks back at the house. A lot of work. He had none. When Roger Best got back to Ruby, he didn't even change his clothes. He gunned the motor of the ambulance hearse and sped to the convent. Three women were down in the grass, he'd been told, one in the kitchen, another across the hall. He searched everywhere, every inch of grass, every patch of scotch broom, the hen house, the garden, every row of corn in the field beyond, then every room, the chapel, the schoolroom. The game room was empty, the kitchen too. A sheet and a folded raincoat on the table, the only sign that a body had been there. Upstairs, he looked in both bathrooms, in all eight bedrooms. Again the kitchen, the pantry. Then he went down into the cellar, stepped over the floor paintings. He opened one door that revealed a coal bin. Behind another, a small bed and a pair of shiny shoes on the dresser. No bodies, nothing. Even the Cadillac was gone. Save Marie. This is why we are here, in this single moment of aching sadness, in contemplating the short life and the unacceptable, incomprehensible death of a child. We confirm, defer, or lose our faith. Here in the tick-tock of this moment, in this place, all our questions, all our fear, our outrage, confusion, desolation seem to merge, snatch away the earth, and we feel as though we are falling. Here, we might say, it is time to halt, to linger this one time and reject platitudes about sparrows falling under his eye, about the good dying young. This child didn't have a choice about being good or about death being the only democracy. This is the time to ask questions that are really on our minds. Who could do this to a child? Who could permit this for a child? And why? Sweetie Fleetwood wouldn't discuss it. Her child would not be laid to rest on Stuart Morgan's land. It was a brand new problem. The subject of burial sites had not come up in Ruby for 20 years, and there was astonishment as well as sadness when the task became necessary. When Save Marie, the youngest of Sweetie and Jeff's children, died, people assumed the rest of them, Noah, Esther, and Ming, would quickly follow. The first was given a strong name for a strong son, as well as being the name of his great-grandfather. The second was named Esther for the great-grandmother who loved and cared for the first so selflessly. The third had a name Jeff insisted upon, something having to do with the war. This last child's name was a request or a lament. Save Marie. And who was to say whether the call had not been answered? Thus, the tense discussion of a formal cemetery was not only because of Sweetie's wishes and the expectation of more funerals, but out of a sense that, for complicated reasons, the Reaper was no longer barred entry from Ruby. Richard Meisner was therefore presiding over consecrated ground and launching a new institution. But whether to use the ad hoc cemetery on Stewart's ranch, where Ruby Smith lay, was a question out of the question for Sweetie. Under the influence of her brother, Luther, and blaming Stewart for the trouble he got her husband and father-in-law into, she said she would rather do what Roger Best had done, dug a grave on his own property. And she couldn't care less that 23 years had passed since that quick and poorly attended backyard burial took place. Most people understood why she was making such a fuss. Grief plus blame was a heady brew. But Pat Best believed that Sweetie's stubbornness was more calculated, rejecting a Morgan offer, casting doubt on Morgan righteousness might squeeze some favors from Morgan pockets. And if Pat's eight-rock theory was correct, Sweetie's vindictiveness put the eight-rocks in the awkward position of deciding to have a real and formal cemetery in a town full of immortals. Something seismic had happened since July. So here they were, under a soapy sky on a mild November day, gathered a mile or so beyond the last Ruby house, which was, of course, Morgan land, but nobody had the heart to tell Sweetie so. Standing among the crowd, surrounding the bereaved Fleetwoods, Pat regained something close to stability. Earlier, at the funeral service, the absence of a eulogy had made her cry. Now she was her familiar, dispassionately amused self. At least she hoped she was dispassionate, and hoped amusement was what she was feeling. She knew there were other views about her attitude, some of which Richard Meisner had expressed, sad, sad and cold. But she was a scholar, not a romantic, and steeled herself against Meisner's graveside words to observe the mourners instead. He and Anna Flood had returned 2 days after the assault on the convent women, and it took 4 days for him to learn what had happened. Pat gave him the two editions of the official story. One, that 9 men had gone to talk to and persuade the convent women to leave or mend their ways. There had been a fight. The women took other shapes and disappeared into thin air. And two, the Fleetwood jury version, that 5 men had gone to evict the women, that 4 others, the authors, had gone to restrain or stop them. These 4 were attacked by the women, but had succeeded in driving them out, and they took off in their Cadillac. But